Okay, this is talking with Dr. John Blythe over the telephone from Cambridge to his home in Chelmsford on 18th May 1981. Well, if we could start, please, if you could tell me what your educational background was and when you first came into contact with radio astronomy.
I was educated secondary school at the Romford Royal Liberty School. Took the normal subject for O-level, which is at 16, and at A-level, or high school certificate as we called it then, I took pure maths, applied maths, physics and chemistry.
Right.
And I had distinctions in pure and applied maths and physics, and a credit in chemistry, and I was awarded a state scholarship, which took me to Christ College, Cambridge, and I went up in 1950.
Right.
And for my first year, I read mathematics, part one of the mathematical tripos, and obtained the first class honours. And then I changed to natural sciences tripos to read physics, and took the part two of the natural sciences tripos in 1953, where I had a 2-1.
Right.
After certain amount of time spent on other activities, particularly football.
That's right. I guess I have actually heard other people mention your football skill.
Yeah. Well,
You played for the Cambridge first team?
Yes, I didn't get into the Cambridge first team until that third year. And normally the blue is awarded by playing for the university against Oxford. That match normally happens in December. In December of 1952, there was fog at Wembley, and all the selections were withdrawn.
So
I was faced with the option of either concentrating on degree and dropping the blue, or carrying on with football for a further term, and that was the option that I adopted.
Okay.
But then I joined the radio astronomy group, radio group, summer of 1953.
After you had your physics degree?
After.
Right. Now, on what basis did you join them? Because you heard about their work and were interested, or did they come to you? Or?
As part of the tripos, part of the natural sciences tripos, there were some optional further subjects, and one of these optional further subjects was some lectures in radio astronomy given by Martin Ryle.
Oh, yes.
And I attended these lectures. I previously felt that I would be interested in doing research. I have to admit that one of the factors in making me want to do research was the fact that I didn't get the first that I expected in part two. I got a 2-1.
Yes.
Rather felt that I'd blotted my copybook and would like to get a PhD.
I see. Huh.
And when I found that the SRC were prepared to offer me, or rather DSIR as it was at that time,
right,
prepared to offer me a research place, I had various options, and I remember one of the cases was to do with surface physics, but that didn't interest me as much as the radio astronomy work.
What was it that appealed about it to you? Was it just the Ryle's lectures primarily that?
Well, I found Ryle's lectures very interesting. Right throughout the practical physics class, I found that I'd done the radio experiments. I found radio very interesting.
I see.
I had a brother-in-law who was with the post office and had been concerned with certain radio matters, and I generally felt that that was a very much more interesting subject than the rather complex physics that you encounter in surface solid state.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you joined the group then, exactly when was it again?
In the summer of 1953.
And what project did you begin working on? How was it determined? Somebody just said, all right, begin working on this?
Well, I've been trying to recollect exactly when my project was first mooted. I noticed in David Edge's book, he says that the notebook suggests that that project was first mentioned in 1954. That's a at least a term after I started.
In Ryle's notebook?
No, I'm talking about the book from David Edge.
Right, but you said it's in somebody's notebook.
Yes.
Which notebook?
I haven't been in fact, to check that reference.
I see. I'll have to. I can check that myself.
But the my own recollection is that it was decided fairly early on, and within that first term, what the various projects would be, and that the idea of aperture synthesis was already in Martin Ryle's mind before I started.
So this was your project that, as well as for other students, that was going to be your dissertation work. It was, you didn't have a practice project, and then you did your dissertation.
No, that's right.
Right.
My recollection is that I did some introductory reading in the summer and started on that project quite early on.
I see, okay.
And it was, there were three research students who started that year. There was myself and Robin Conway.
Yes, I've talked to him.
Intended that he would start on solar physics. And George Whitfield, and he also had a new kind of radio telescope, which was crossed arrays of two linear arrays of Yagi's crossed in space.
Right. Well, as it turns out, I have an appointment to talk with him tomorrow evening, so I'll be getting his story then.
Is he still at Reading?
Let's see. Where is he? I've been dealing with so many people that I get people confused, but I have the list right here. Yes, he's in the Department of Cybernetics at Reading.
Yes, good.
Right.
He did a very interesting television program on pterodactyls years ago.
I see. So anyway, the work was split up amongst you three students.
Yes, we had separate projects, and my project turned out to require rather a lot of constructional work, and so I had a great deal of assistance from various other people.
And who were these people primarily?
Well, from I think Robin Conway was the primary one who helped me with the original work.
Mm-hmm.
But all the people in the group at various times, I think, lent a hand in one way or another.
Well, that's something I wanted to ask about in terms of the operating style of the group. This is still at the Grange Road site. And was it a matter that if you needed a couple extra hands on a particular day, you just went around and rounded them up, or?
Oh, that was right, yes.
But also, in terms of being a research student, were you quite independent and only going for help when you needed it, or was it something that you sort of checked in every day and reported on what you were doing and got further advice?
Checking in every day, in the sense of sitting in or clocking in. If you didn't attend pretty regularly, questions would be asked, and this again was a problem with me with playing football. But in fact, at the end of my first term as research student, I was fortunate enough to be invited to go on a tour of Hong Kong.
Oh, good heavens.
And that led to a certain amount of...
Let me just. So, can you tell me then what was the task as you saw it at that time, and what were the problems that you faced in trying to achieve it?
Well, the first task was to try and Martin Ryle set out the idea behind the new aperture synthesis principle. It wasn't called that at the time. I forget what it was called, but he set out the principle of this new telescope. And it needed a certain amount of analysis in order to be able to understand the operation, to establish things like the distance that you should move the moving aerial, and how the aerial should be designed.
And the weighting of the spacings. And
that's right. Yes. And so having done initial analysis work on principles, then the antenna itself was designed. The elements were fast wire dipoles over reflecting screens, which rested very much on previous work that had been done. And I'm not quite sure who did that work, but certainly Tony Hewish helped me with the design of the individual dipoles.
Uh-huh. And I also would like to ask, while I think of it, about the relationship of your work to that of Machen and O'Brien, who were doing a bit of synthesis too, but only one-dimensional and then a cross-type synthesis. How do you see the relationship between your work and theirs?
Well, it hadn't occurred to me that either of them were doing that kind of work. I knew both of them, of course, and I must have, for the moment, I find it difficult to remember just what they were doing.
Well, they did not have the phase information. I mean, that's one big difference. They had to assume a symmetric distribution. But they were measuring amplitudes at different spacings and trying to get the cross, the profile across the sun. That was what Machen did in one dimension, and O'Brien did in two dimensions. Although he didn't do a full synthesis, he was trying to get the profile at perpendicular angles and trying to put together an image of the sun, so to speak. But it sounds like that you were not directly talking with them and did not consider yourself to sort of...
I mean, we all... Ken Machen had left the group by the time that I joined it, but I certainly knew him, and he certainly appeared from time to time, and I certainly had discussions with him on things like noise. I don't remember seeing the operation of this the instrument that I was concerned with as having been connected with his kind of interference or visibility.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of experience.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Okay.
Now, it may be that Martin had seen it, and perhaps the idea had come to him as an extension of that kind of principle.
Right.
But it was presented to me as a new kind of idea.
Okay. Now, so you said you worked on the some of the theory of what was needed, and then these aerials were not a unique design, but nevertheless a lot of work to get them built and... and working themselves. And what other problems were faced in making this a working system?
Well, the things I do remember a great deal of discussion about. As I remember it, the design of the aerials all went quite smoothly, and construction, you know, it was a long and tedious process, but I don't remember any particular difficulties about it. The thing that was always seen as rather a problem was how to carry out the what we would now call the synthesis operation.
Right.
Like the Fourier transform. And early experiments were supported by the manual techniques of the time, which were things called Lips and Beaver strips.
Yes, I've heard about those.
And Martin Ryle proposed that a special purpose instrument should be constructed, and there was a great deal of discussion as to how that instrument should be constructed.
Mm-hmm.
He saw a possible design being based on the use of precision resistance as the amplitude setting element.
Oh, I see.
A kind of analog of Lips and Beaver strips.
So this would be an analog computer, really?
That's right, yes. He had discussions with Wilkes, the director of the computer laboratory.
Right.
I've forgotten what the proper title of it is. On the nature of this problem. And I think it had been concluded that it wasn't really a suitable problem for EDSAC because of the enormous amount of data that would have to be stored. That we were, with the parameters, the size, the aperture, and so on that we ended up with, we recorded data, as I recollect, every 4 minutes.
Right.
And there's an awful lot of 4 minutes in a day.
Right.
And an awful lot of spacings. And altogether, it amounts to a lot of data, which, as I recollect, exceeded the EDSAC store, so it was felt that that wasn't practical.
Well, I think that in core anyway, there was only 1,000 words you quoted somewhere in the EDSAC. You didn't actually mention how much there might be in other kinds of storage, but I think probably at that time that was it, that there was no other kind of storage.
Well, I've used so many computers since. I had a feeling that there was more than the one. The main storage medium was a delay line. I had a feeling that there was more than one delay line there, but perhaps.
Well, that could be. That could be. I mean, I don't know. Yeah.
I was discussing this with a friend of mine, a chap called Charles Lindsay, who was also a research student at Christ's, a chap with whom I had the power all the way through, and who was in the mathematical laboratory. And he pointed out that all that I needed was to carry out the Fourier transform on the data that had been measured at the same sidereal time every day, and this wouldn't exceed the storage limits, provided one did this rotation of the memory, if I describe in the thesis that you've referred to.
Right.
And so that was how the idea, or rather, it's from that conversation, Charles Lindsay's suggestion, that the germ of the computer program arose.
I see. So once you realized that you could do sort of one dimension at a time, rather than doing a full two-dimensional transform all at once, is that basically a correct way of saying it?
That's right.
Yeah. And so Martin Ryle agreed to this and gave up on the idea of the analog computer?
Yes.
Now, one thing I notice is that you you acknowledge this fellow Wilkes at the computer for making available the time. I gather then that it was not a general purpose instrument available to the university. It was sort of their own research tool, and it was only at their pleasure that they let you use it.
Well, I think that's it was run on a more open basis than that. They had it was operated as a tool for general use by the university.
Oh, it was, I see. Okay.
There was a panel of people, and various projects were submitted to them, and I can remember attending a sitting of this panel to describe my project, and they were at the same time considering a whole lot of other projects.
Right.
And they could only accept a number of projects within the time available. And I remember that I was asking for 12 hours of EDSAT time, and they allocated me 20.
Mm-hmm.
I felt this was a bit unnecessary at the time, but in fact I used most of the 20.
In fact, I think you somewhere in your thesis you said that you needed 25 or something like that to do the synthesis. But in fact, that's not really all that much time. I mean, you weren't requiring weeks and weeks of this computer by any means.
No.
Yeah.
No, and I remember them. The time was granted without really a great deal of discussion.
On the other hand, you only did this one transform, though. You didn't play around with different parameters and try many different transforms.
No, I just sorted out the equations from my original theory and programmed those and perform the calculations just once.
Right. I mean, for instance, one thing I would think of immediately would be different gradings to try different synthesized beams, but you didn't try any of that.
We did some initial experiments. A lot of that was actually done with the Lips and Beavers strips, because that was done in the very early days, before we decided on the computer program, the EDSAC program, to carry out the main transform.
I see. Can you tell me about the nature of what you did then?
The work was to look for a distribution that would give as good a resolution as possible without excessive side load.
Mm-hmm.
I find it difficult to recall now, but I think we were aiming at something like 1% side loads.
Right.
And we considered various kinds. I have a feeling at this time Robin Conway was also involved in this work. We looked at various kinds of distributions, truncated Gaussian and various others.
Right.
And we'd go along to the mathematical laboratory. They'd use Marchant's electric calculating machines and the Lips and Beavers strips to calculate the expected further diagram.
I see.
And the final design was carried out on that basis.
I see. So this was part of what you did pretty early in your project.
That's right.
I see. So then,
by the time I got to the EDSAC, that design, I'm now talking about the grading along the length of the long aperture, was fixed.
Right.
There was a process of trying to correct that distribution to achieve the desired design photodiagram as part of the project. I'm not too happy about the basis on which that was done.
So you mean you weren't able to physically achieve exactly what you wanted?
That's right.
And so you had a correction procedure?
That's right.
And is that described in your thesis? I didn't...
It is, yes. The correction procedure worked on sections of the antenna, 8 elements at a time.
I see.
And using Cassiopeia A, as I recollect, the side of Cassiopeia A, go back and Fourier transform that to say what the actual distribution, the actual excitation the antenna was, correct it, go back and try again. And I'm not sure that the signal to noise, the sensitivity of that process was properly worked out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll take a look at that further in your thesis.
However, at the end, the whole thing was put together and the pattern was was looked at, and we felt it was sufficiently good to proceed. Certain areas of the sky got wiped out by side lobes from Cassiopeia A and things of that kind.
Right, right.
I don't think I would have ever avoided that.
Were there no problems in what we now call debugging your programs? I mean, did that go reasonably smoothly and not take up much computer time?
I don't remember great problems. I must admit, at the time I was delighted to have an excuse to learn how to computer program, and I approached the whole programming aspect with great enthusiasm, and I was very happy to work long hours on that part of it.
Which was the language that was used?
Well, it was in machine code. EdSec had its own machine code.
I see. So there were no higher level languages?
Not at that time,
no. Right.
It wasn't quite as basic a machine code as some of the other machines at the time. Cambridge was, the laboratory was very forward looking in its software developments. It had a library of software by the time I joined, which was 1955. I went on the summer of 1955, I went on the programming course, and there was already an extensive library of subroutines, and they had things like relative addressing, which was fairly advanced for the time. So it wasn't a very big program by present-day standards, I don't remember it in a great deal of time.
Right. Okay. Going back to the hardware side of things, it would seem to me from the work you describe in your thesis that you got rather involved in many aspects of the hardware, virtually building all kinds of filters and matching stubs and all kinds of things like this yourself. Is that correct?
I particularly remember the matching stubs, yes. The cable that was used was the thicker cable, was it? I forget the number. Was it UR1?
RU1.
RU1.
I believe that's correct.
That the stubs needed an element, a connector, which would enable four of these cables to come together. And at the time, there wasn't such a connector. Largely with help from Martin, I designed a connector for this UR, a four-way connector for this cable.
That's
the base with tuning stubs. Matching stubs.
Right.
That was to feed the three of the eight element sections in the antenna.
And what about the receivers themselves? Were they pretty standard for that time?
The basic phase switch receiver, I just used a standard receiver. I remember having to build a low noise amplifier, which was a little unusual at 38 megahertz, because the sky temperature basically
supports
normal receivers. But I had, as I recollect, something like 9 dBs of cable loss, and so it was felt worthwhile building a low-noise receiver, and that was built with a double triode, a cascode circuit.
Mm-hmm. And on what basis was 38 megahertz chosen for the frequency?
It was an available frequency. We only had certain frequencies that were available. The idea of this antenna was to find a way of constructing a high-resolution instrument, so it seemed natural to try it at lower frequencies, which is where resolution was the problem.
Right,
it had
right.
low gain, and again, this was suitable for the lower frequencies where gain wasn't the problem.
Right.
And so, basically, the choice was the lowest frequency that we had available.
And
if you go much lower, 20 megahertz, you begin to run into ionospheric problems.
Right. But now a related question is, on what basis did you choose either the resolution on the sky or the size of your aerial?
Well, the size of the aerial, the length of the long element, was chosen to be the longest that we could fit onto the site.
Okay, very practical.
That's right. And that was why we ended up with a funny number of 48 elements. It was, we just ran into site restrictions at either end.
Right. And that gave a 2-degree beam, which was still, of course, a great improvement over what had been available at that kind of a frequency.
Yes. Yes, a similar argument applied to the movement of the small antenna. We took it across a field as far as we could go. It was the field that the army were. It was part of the rifle range. And I took it as far as the hedges airfield, and I couldn't go any farther.
Right. Now, for the actual observations, it appears that it took something like a 6-month period in late 1955. And could you tell me about them? Were they such that you had to be present during the entire time, or?
Not during the entire time. Once the antenna was set up, of course it was a recording, a chart recorder which ran. In fact, most of the observations were taken at night. The daytime observations are generally so subject to interference and not to be valid. So it was mostly the nighttime measurements that were used. The particular problem with the antenna was that the phase, the relative phase of the two arms, the two antennas, was very much affected by moisture. And of course we didn't monitor moisture. What we actually did was to look at the very bright radio stars and to check the phase of the very bright radio stars.
Right.
The particular element that was sensitive was the twin feeder on the moving dipole.
Mm-hmm.
This was a particular kind of cable that was normally used, and it had a kind of dumbbell cross-section, if you can visualize what I mean.
Yes.
So there was a trough on either side.
Yes.
In which water would be retained by surface tension. And that very dramatically affected the dielectric constant and the phase velocity.
Yeah, I see.
And in retrospect, that cable should never have been used, but one is wise after the event.
Sure, sure. But of course, this brings up a general question I wanted to ask about the whole business of aperture synthesis. It seems to me that once one has the idea, that there are two key things that make it feasible. One, in fact, is a computer, and the second thing is having the phase stability. But now, it seems from what you're saying, I mean, you haven't mentioned until now that there were any breakthroughs in receiver or aerial developments that allowed you to get the superior phase stability. Did you have to work on this harder than others had?
No, I just used the existing designs. As I say, I found that I had to check the phase, and it was just a matter of rejecting those measurements for which the phase was unsatisfactory.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it was not any new development along those lines, but obviously you had to keep good track of it if you were going to get a proper map out.
Yes, I was, of course, beginning to run out of time, and so I was perhaps rather wanting to take the quickest solution. It was a very early test of a principle.
Right, right.
So it wouldn't have been appropriate to indulge in a long development to make everything just right.
Right. Well, this fact that the daytime observations proved pretty useless must have extended the observations out, obviously, longer than you would have liked.
Yes.
Now, another question I had was about the relationship, as you saw it at that time, between what you were doing and the Mills Cross principle, which had been published, and of course, data was coming from the Mills Cross in Australia.
Well, my recollection is that, I at any rate, wasn't aware of the Mills Cross when I started. I think we became aware of it fairly early on.
I think the paper actually is in 1953, the first publication about it.
Well, we would have seen that. Can you remind me just which month it was?
Oh, I don't know which month. It's a paper in the Australian Journal of Physics.
Yes, well, we certainly took that.
Describing the principles of the Mills Cross by Mills and Little.
Well, my recollection is that at the time that I was looking at the principle of this instrument, we weren't aware of the Mills
mm-hmm.
Cross.
Okay. But anyway, you shortly did become aware of it.
Yes, by the time we were building, we were aware.
And what did you see as the pros and cons of your approach to that of the Mills Cross?
I can remember discussions on this point, and one point that was made was that in the Mills Cross, in effect, they didn't have a DC component.
Yes, that's right.
And this had various effects. One was on the general level of the background, but also on certain side lobes. And I can remember discussions. Peter Scheuer had gone off into the service, and I can remember that
he wrote a letter setting this out, and Martin was read this out one Saturday morning and was very pleased with such a clear analysis of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
It generally felt that they were interested in stars, whereas we were looking at the broad scale structure.
Right. But now, of course...
another aspect was that what we were doing was basically a cheap method. We were only building half the antenna that they were building.
Right. But did require this computational...
perhaps we were spoiled, but we didn't have to pay for our computer.
Yeah. Well, and you had one available. I mean, that wasn't always true then either. Let's see, what was I going to say? It just escaped my mind here. So in any case, the Mills Cross did not, as far as you know, directly influence what you were doing. It was something you considered, but you felt that this was a good way to go. And
my recollection is that decisions had been largely taken by the time we became aware about it.
Yeah, okay. Now,